It's Monday. That means another week of news and another week of discussions on Today in Ohio, the news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. I heard from some listeners to this podcast over the weekend because they were asking to buy the photos of the eclipse that we made an offer for, and they said very kind things, which is wonderful to hear from you. Thank you for listening. I'm Chris Quinn, here with Lisa Garvin, Leila Atassi, and Laura Johnston, and let's get to it. We're going to start with this because it's critically important. Is Aisha's Law finally headed to passage, the first law in a long time that might actually protect potential domestic violence victims from harm, Leila?
Yeah, they've tried before with Aisha's Law, and they're trying again, Chris. Representatives Sarah Carruthers, who's a Cincinnati Republican, and Juanita Brent, a Cleveland Democrat, they've co-sponsored the reintroduction of this bill as House Bill 486. It's passed the House twice, but it's gone absolutely nowhere in the Senate. This time, the bill is simpler. It's just 77 pages long, around half the length of the bill that was introduced during the 21-22 legislative session. And they removed from it a special provision on strangulation because that actually made it into another bill that passed and was signed into law during the last legislative session that made Ohio the very last state to recognize strangulation as a standalone crime. But one key provision that remains in Aisha's Law is the requirement that law enforcement, when responding to domestic violence calls, use an evidence-based lethality assessment screening tool that signals when a victim is at high risk of being killed by their partner. Research shows that certain domestic violence acts, like strangulation, carry a tenfold increase in the risk of the victim being killed eventually. And under the bill, officers would be required to provide victims of strangulation a very specific, scripted warning about how great that danger is, and to encourage the victim to seek medical attention and advocacy. And also importantly, if the victim consents, officers under this law would be able to request an emergency protection order from a judicial officer, even when the court is not open for regular business hours. So this is such an important step. Hopefully this time around, it'll make it across the finish line without any pushback.
Why would any woman in Ohio or in his district vote for Matt Huffman? He stands in the way of this. This wouldn't get passed in his Senate before. He stands in the way of child care. These are absolutely good laws, right? We've seen it time and time again. Guy threatens woman. Woman calls police. Police try to do what they can. Guy either injures or kills the woman. This is actually a tangible move that could help protect women. And it always was. From the moment this thing was proposed, it was a good idea. And yet, Matt Huffman's Senate won't pass it. I don't get it. Why would you stand in the way of something like this?
I don't know. I don't know what the sticking point could possibly be. Laura Hancock says in her story that prosecutors took issue with previous iterations of the bill because it dictated too heavily how DV cases could be prosecuted. But they're not taking any issue with this version. So hopefully this will move it along. It'll be a rare moment of bipartisan cooperation to do the right thing.
Let's hope. This is much needed. It's why we're talking about it at the top of the podcast. I can't tell you how many stories we've done over the years that detail women trying to protect themselves and it not working. This could actually work. They need to move this through and get it signed. You're listening to Today in Ohio. A bunch of Republicans remain angry that Jason Stevens built a coalition with Democrats, oh my gosh, to become House Speaker, and they keep messing with him to punish him. What are the latest tactics they are using, and are they simply inept? Are their efforts always going to fail?
I don't know. I think they're probably going to keep trying, but we're talking about money here in this part of the power struggle. So Stevens is still in charge of the Ohio House Republican Alliance and its bank account. And Jeremy Peltzer talked to him. He called his rivals pirates, which is a great word, derided their work to strip him of power. And this is part of this larger war that we've been talking about ever since Stevens was elected as House Speaker, which is one of the most powerful positions in state government because it's over the House. He's leading the House. And Stevens got elected with the help of Democratic votes over Republican Derek Marin, the Toledo area representative, who was backed by a majority of House Republicans. And they've been fighting ever since. So this is, the money matters because of how many pro-Huffman Republicans get elected to the House in November. And that's decided by the amount of financial support the alliance gives the GOP in the competitive races. And these individual campaign contribution limits are higher than the limits for the to the individual candidates. So you can give more money if you give through this Republican alliance, and that's what they're fighting about. Who can have control of that bank account? And they filed a lawsuit in Franklin County. The judge denied a request for an injunction, but said if there was a clear record of the majority of House Republicans voting to shift control to the alliance, then he would maybe likely say side with those Republicans. So that's what they're trying to do here to meet that bar. 40 of 66 House Republicans voted last week during a closed-door meeting for a resolution to give Plummer control of the OHRA instead of Stevens.
I can't believe how deep this battle is going, because there's only, what, 7 months, 6 months left, or 8 months left in his term before this gets redone again. Why they keep trying to do this? I guess it's because they're preparing for another fight, but they've tried everything so far, but they're kind of clowns because they can't land a blow. He keeps beating them.
Right. So their view is if they get enough of their pro-Huffman Republicans elected instead of the pro-Stevens Republicans, that he's going to lose his seat as soon as the caucus meets after the November elections. So that's why this money matters. And we've talked on this podcast all the time about how much campaign contributions dictate what our legislature does. And that's another example of this. This is inside party politics, not necessarily the outside interests, but they're trying to buy the speakership with this money by who they get elected.
All right, let's go there, Lisa. Jeremy Pelzer did a deep dive on the battle Stevens is having with the Senate president for the House speakership next year. I was glad to see Stevens finally say something I was been saying is, what kind of audacity do you have to be the leader of a different body and just presume you're going to walk in and take over the House? It's a story that's filled with all sorts of juicy tidbits. Stevens actually talked about this, so let's talk about what he said.
Yeah, the Lawrence County Republican used many adjectives to describe Matt Huffman's attempt to become House Speaker, among them unfortunate, revealing, very suspicious, not in the best interest of Ohio. And he also said that Huffman really shouldn't be able to jump from one leadership position to another without any interruption at all. He also called it hilarious that Huffman seems to be seeking Democratic support for his House Speaker bid. And as we know, Stevens was censured by the Ohio Republican Party for the way he was elected by Dems. And now he says now he wants to talk to the Democrats. Well, the party censured Huffman too. Both men say they have the necessary votes next January, but four Stevens supporters did lose their primary election. So that changes the math a little bit. And we've talked recently about term limits being loosened. That kind of came from Stevens' camp. It's backed by both men, but Stevens, the one who brought it up, he says, actually, it's because of this looming fight with Huffman. He said, without term limits, Huffman would just stay put in the Senate and not come over to the House. So we did talk to Huffman spokesman John Fortney, and he says it's difficult to lead when Stevens was elected the way that he was, meaning with Democratic support. He says Huffman has 8 years experience in the House, needed now more than ever. And he said now leaders should talk to the other side of the aisle, but counting on the entire Democratic caucus to elect you is not what leaders do.
Yeah, Fortney is that clown that's created Ohio's version of Pravda, where they're trying to pretend to be a news source. So you have to take everything he says with a serious grain of salt. He has zero credibility. What I like about what Steven says, because nobody else seems to be talking about it, the presumption that Huffman has that he can walk into the House and take it over. There are dozens and dozens of House members that have been there a while who probably would make better leaders than him. Huffman's been a terrible leader. We just talked about it. He won't get behind child care. He stood in the way of Aisha's law. He was one of the leaders in the effort to completely neutralize our ability to change the Constitution. He is terrible for Ohio. If you were in the House, why would you want to bring this guy with his monstrous behavior in to be your leader? And Stevens is kind of getting there, saying, yeah, what is that about? You just go from one to the other like you're the king of Ohio.
Mm-hmm. And he was very forthcoming. I really like Jason Stevens. I'm so glad that it wasn't Derek Maron that was chosen instead of him. He does have a modicum of restraint, and he sees things in not through pink rose-colored glasses.
And he was the guy that said, I'm going to defer to what the voters said on marijuana mm-hmm. when everybody else was so up in arms that they thought they had to change it. So I'm with you. And I like the idea of a guy who got elected with bipartisan support. It's right. amazing to me that that is now like the biggest sin you commit. What? You talk to a Democrat? Fie, fie, you must leave our party immediately. And they did that. The Republican Party censured him because mm-hmm. he had the audacity to reach across the aisle. Look what Ohio's become. And that's Matt Huffman. I mean, Matt Huffman is that kind of guy.
And for Fortney to say, basically saying, we don't want you to work with the Democrats at all.
I know. But remember, that guy is a joke. He ought to be on Fox News. You are listening to Today in Ohio. We had a couple of good stories about the going nowhere, not at all real proposal to build a new Brown Stadium in Brook Park. In the first, Sean McDonnell examined whether team owners Dee and Jimmy Haslam could ever recover a $1.5 to $2 billion investment in a new stadium through an entertainment and or retail district. Not hardly, huh, Laura?
No, this does not sound like a very feasible way to make money. If it were to be successful, and that's a big if, it would still take about two decades to break even on a $2 billion investment. And obviously, we have no guarantee it'll be successful. This is Northeast Ohio. It's not a growing market. And every time we build some new retail establishment, the older one goes bust. So I love this line from Sean McDonnell, who did great work here. He said, we don't have ballpark figures, but we do have figures from a ballpark. Because a lot of these aren't public entities and they're not sharing their bottom line. He did look at Truist Park and the Battery Atlanta, which is a stadium and mixed use development built by the Braves outside of Atlanta. It's a 2 million square foot development, retail, restaurants, a hotel, music venue, and multiple corporate headquarters. So a whole lot of base here. Plus, it's a baseball park, which means it has 367 events in a year, which is obviously more than one a day. And that's a whole lot more than we're talking for football games in a football stadium. But still, they made about $59 million in 2023. So think about how long that would take right. to add up to $2 billion.
Right. It's a great story by Sean. And it does, once again, we've had a number of these stories that show how preposterous this idea is. You don't become a billionaire by making investment in things that don't return an investment. This has all been a chess match because they're trying to jack Cleveland for their last $100 million or something.
Sean talked to a number of people and looked at different developments across the country. The one that was more optimistic than the rest was the Canton Pro Football Hall of Fame. And I'm like, but every time we write about that, it feels like, oh, it's delayed again, yeah. or this isn't happening. I would not look to that development as the harbinger of success that we want to replicate, an hour north. I mean, it'd be great, but they're like working to build a similar mixed-use development.
But it's also something that will take forever to recover the investment. That's the thing. This just and as we pointed out, this doesn't expand retail. We never right. see that. Pinecrest started, and now Legacy Village is being drained, and we just see retail move around. Our buying power hasn't changed because our population isn't growing.
Correct.
So it just displaces. And even if they got it there, it's not clear it would work. And like Sean points out, it's a long-term payback. Good perspective on this continuing kind of story. You're listening to Today in Ohio. As we have noted, Cleveland could exercise the Art Modell Law to block any move of the Browns from Cleveland. The law has been used only once, and in that case, the Haslams were the good guys, saving a team rather than as the uprooter looking to stick it to their host city. Reporter Lucas DePrele took a deeper look at the previous case. Layla, what do we learn?
The Art Modell Law, as many know, was passed in 96 after Art Modell uprooted the Browns and moved them to Baltimore. And it requires teams to provide their hometown 6 months' notice before a move and to give locals a chance to buy the team before they try to sell it elsewhere. Only once in history, as you said, has it ever been invoked in any real way, and that was in a lawsuit filed by the state of Ohio and the city of Columbus seeking to keep the Columbus Crew soccer team in Columbus. And in that case, very ironically, one of the key beneficiaries turned out to be the Haslams, who swooped in to heroically buy the team while that was working its way through the court. Of course, now the Haslams are suggesting that they might move the Browns out of Cleveland and into Brook Park if it seems more suitable to them, and that has resurrected the conversation about the Art Modell law. So the backstory on the Crew, if we're looking through a historical lens here, Precourt Sports Ventures LLC had purchased this team in 2013, and initially they had pledged to keep the team in Columbus. But 4 years later, the team owner, Anthony Precourt, wasn't happy with how business was going in Ohio and said he wanted to move the team to Austin, Texas. And fans were totally outraged by this. And then in March 2018, Mike DeWine, who was Ohio Attorney General at the time, and the city of Columbus, they filed a lawsuit against Precourt Sports Ventures and Major League Soccer, citing the Art Modell law. And Precourt argued that the law was unconstitutional. The U.S. Constitution prohibits state governments from taking actions that, quote, unduly burden interstate commerce. It's called the Dormant Commerce Clause. And it's the reason that Ohio can't place tariffs or bans on products made in Michigan or Indiana, for example. And they argued that the Art Modell law prohibits them from participating in out-of-state commerce. But that argument got rejected. And during this 90-day pause in the litigation, Haslam announced that he and another investor would be buying the team for $150 million to keep it in Columbus. And the case was eventually dismissed on account of that deal. So that left some legal questions still unanswered regarding the Art Modell law, which makes for a really interesting conversation today, considering that Cleveland City Councilman in recent weeks has suggested that the Haslams might be violating that law if indeed they move the Browns from Cleveland to Brook Park.
Well, you wouldn't be able to use the Interstate Commerce Clause because it'd be staying in state. So I don't know. The law might be more powerful in this case. There are some wondering whether the Brook Park thing is a dodge, and their real goal is to move the Browns to Columbus, where they're building their sports empire. Mm. You know, there's rumors about the Blue Jackets, for instance, which would be an earthquake. I'm not sure the state government would want to get involved in something like that, pitting cities against each other. And so it'll be interesting to see. They have the big investment in Columbus. They have the big investment in Cleveland, you know, and they're trying to get more money from the city for the Brown Stadium.
Oh, I was just going to say that I think this seemed like the bottom line through, you know, talking to the experts that Lucas touched base with is that nothing about the Art Modell law would actually necessarily block the Haslams from moving the team. They could easily give the city 6 months notice, entertain offers locally to sell the team. They're not required to accept any of those offers. And then they can move the team wherever they want. I mean, I don't think that the Art Modell law itself is the block against moving a team that we, you know, have thought it is.
No, but it villainizes the owners by pitting them against the city. And I don't think people love being villainized. You can just ask the Art Modell family about how much Art Modell, who has since died, enjoyed being the pariah of Cleveland. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Lisa, last week when we talked about the Greyhound bus station sale, we were befuddled as to what its use might be. And then Steve Litt came through with a great story laying out the possibilities. What might happen there?
We don't know for sure, but we do know what it will not be. So Steve talked to Playhouse Square President and CEO Craig Hassel. He says they are absolutely committed to preserving the 1948 streamlined modern building. And I didn't know this. It's on the National Register of Historic Places. He says he doesn't want to do what other cities have done, where they just tear down the back of the building and keep the facade and put like apartments or whatever behind it. He also does not want to put a new theater in there. What he envisions is a casual entertainment and dining spaces, and this would help revitalize what he calls an urban dead zone, because along Chester Avenue, there are parking lots and garages that have their back to the street, so it's kind of like a fortress. So he wants to make that more attractive and safer with this Greyhound building and make a new welcoming entry to Playhouse Square. He says he doesn't want to increase the fortress, and interestingly enough, back in 1987, Playhouse Square built a 750-space parking garage, and that kind of contributed to the fortress-like look of the place. So They're working with a group, a global consulting firm called Street Sense, and they want to talk about possible future uses and have a marketing analysis of the area. He says they may have like a temporary stage show next year to claim the space, but otherwise, you know, he wants to see what they're going to do. He says the building's in good shape, probably needs a new roof, and they'll have to make other repairs. And then there were some fuel tanks that were buried there for the buses, and they were removed as part of the sale.
Steve points out that kind of fortress mentality. There's even that restaurant there that has a wall and it's raised up. Mm-hmm. That garage is a huge barrier. I don't see how you can bring this space into the Playhouse Square neighborhood unless you do some major work to the bottom of that garage and put street retail or something in, because it is, you may as well have a brick wall. And so if you're in Playhouse Square, how likely are you to go past that fortress to get to the bus station? I love what they're talking about. I don't see how they're going to accomplish it with that garage there. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Well, the residents of East Palestine who get settlement payments for the harm they suffered in last year's big train derailment have to pay taxes on what they get, Laura.
Sherrod Brown says no. He wants the IRS and the Treasury Department to ensure that anyone who got those payouts don't have to pay taxes from Norfolk Southern. And so he sent a letter to Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and the IRS Commissioner Daniel Werfel to take these steps to inform the residents that anything paid or reimbursed by Norfolk Southern are qualified disaster relief payments, therefore are excluded from taxable income. And this is a tax deal that was reached between the House and the Senate earlier this year that has provisions that include that, but it hasn't yet become law. So it sounds like everybody's in agreement here. He just wants to make sure that anyone who got this money doesn't think they have to declare it and pay taxes on it, because it's just to make them whole from what they lost. It's not income.
Yeah, this is pretty normal, right? In any kind of disaster, you don't have to pay taxes on what you get because it's just reimbursing you from your losses.
That's my understanding. And this doesn't affect any of the lawsuits from the U.S. Department of Justice or the Ohio Attorney General's office, which are still ongoing against Norfolk Southern. Obviously, we talked about the $600 million settlement last week, so which is a lot of money, but not when you've lost everything.
It sounds like Sherrod Brown is piling on here because the government's already said you don't have to pay, right?
Right. It just, he's bringing attention to it. And on tax day, we're talking about it.
Yeah. So, and he's running for re-election. So yes, he's putting his name out there. You're listening to Today in Ohio. All right, Lisa, this is yours. Sekulowski's University Inn, which closed 4 years ago, is having a special sale likely to draw widespread interest. You're the one that clued us into this and we did the story. What's it about?
This is so exciting, you know, because I walk over there all the time. I walk from Rivergate Park to the Sokolowski's Outlook, and I always wonder, what are they going to do with all that cool stuff that was in their restaurant? So owner Mike Sokolowski says, it's time to get rid of it. We've been meaning to do this, and this is kind of the final straw in their journey from when they closed during the pandemic after 93 years in business. So on Saturday, May 4th, from 9 to 4, they're going to be selling that memorabilia in the Seamus O. Building, which is at 47th and Lorraine in Ohio City. It's a cash-only sale. And you can expect if you've ever been in that restaurant, you can expect to see a whole lot of different stuff. There are hundreds of photos and autographs from celebrities and sports stars that covered the wall, including Jim Brown and Frankie Yankovic, the King of Polka. Also, there are neon signs. There are pennants from the Cleveland Indians 1948 and 1954 World Series. There's a historic Cleveland panoramic photo or two. There are bar stools, a butcher block table, copper pots. They even have taxidermy in there. And they also have some items from Licey's Brewery, which closed in 1958. And they expect a lot of collector interest for these. These were items that they got when his dad delivered beer for Licey's before World War II. They liked him so much, they gave him all this free stuff. And so Mike Sokolowski says, yeah, this is an end of an era. He still has anxiety dreams about the door being left open or someone stealing from the restaurant. And then he says, then you wake up and the restaurant's gone. It opened in 1923 and it closed in 2020 during the pandemic.
You are active in looking at sales like this, and you've said mm-hmm. of late that there's really no bargains anymore because so mm-hmm. many people are tuned into it. So this isn't a place where people will get an autographed photo at a discount. This stuff will all sell, you think, at market prices, right?
It'll be interesting to see how they price it, because at some point he said, I don't think anybody would be interested in a photo of us with celebrities. And I'm like, I think you're wrong about that, especially if there's an autograph. I'm going to try and go, but I expect to see a line out there, especially for these old Brewerania stuff and the neon signs. I think that's going to attract a lot of regional interest.
Yeah, my bet is this will be packed, and you're right. I mean, you went to an estate sale not long ago in Cleveland Heights that was packed, and it was just for a house filled with a lot of old stuff, right?
Right, and people were sleeping in their vans overnight from Detroit, you know? So I don't know. I don't know how much regional play this is going to get before May 4th, but if it does, I think there's going to be a lot of regional interest here.
So people have to get there early and maybe camp out overnight to get the best stuff. You're listening to Today in Ohio. It's a short episode today. Come back Tuesday. We'll be talking about the news. Thanks, Lisa. Thanks, Layla. Thanks, Laura. Thank you for listening.